Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Hi, everybody. It's so nice to see you. I'm Stesha Brandon. Thanks for being here tonight. I'm the Literature and Humanities Program Manager here at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to this evening's program with Calvin Gimbelovich, Genesis Ellis, and Susan Britton. I wanted to thank our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and give thanks to the Seattle Times for their generous promotional support of library programs. Thank you to For Culture for their support of this program as well. And finally, we are grateful to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation from thousands of donors help the library provide free programs and services that touch the lives of everyone in our community. So to Library Foundation donors here with us tonight, we say thank you very much for your support. Before we get started, I have a few additional announcements. I wanted to mention that we have a couple of options for restrooms tonight. There are binary gendered restrooms out of this door and toward the back of the building on level one, and we recommend that you use the restroom that aligns with your gender identity. For patrons who don't feel safe using the binary gendered restrooms, we have two single user restrooms that we're making available, and to access those, you'd go past this piano, and Miranda, staff member here, will direct you to where those restrooms are. Thanks for your patience as the library works to create a better long-term solution to serve our transgender patrons. We are recording tonight's program for the library podcast. If you haven't done so already, please take a minute to silence your phones. And if you would like to listen again, you can look for tonight's podcast on our website in just a couple weeks. You received a survey when you came in. This is an opportunity for you to make your voice heard. We're interested in knowing a bit more about you and what you'd like to see here at the library. So if you take a minute to fill it out, and then you can return it in that little basket on that table there. I read every survey, and I'm interested in knowing what you think. I'm excited to welcome you to tonight's program, Trans Writers Reads, with Calvin, Genesis, and Susan. I think our first reader tonight will be Susan Britton. Susan has lived on two continents in two genders and sailed the bays and oceans as a tall ship captain for over 30 years. Born near London, England, she emigrated to the U.S. in 1980 and now enjoys a quieter life ashore working in Port Townsend at the Writer's Workshop and Imprint Bookstore. Her writing has appeared in numerous publications, including A Potpourri of Poetry and Prose, The Tide Pools Magazine, and Word With You Press. She and her wife are actively involved in the LGBTQ community in Port Townsend and were part of the 2014 documentary, Just Gender. They both lectured at colleges and congregations across the U.S. Please help me welcome Susan Britton.
Good evening, and thank you ever so much for coming out tonight. I'm going to be reading you three pieces. I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction with each piece. The first piece is just called Paul. It's about my oldest brother. I was one of four boys, and my oldest brother was someone that I've always looked up to and still do today, and this is a piece that I wrote for him. As a young boy, I was mesmerized by Atlas, holding the earth on his shoulders. Why had he taken on such an impossible task? And Paul, why you? The oldest brother, the protector. I know you had no choice. It was your job as the oldest. I don't recollect when you became my Atlas, but I remember how. How that night at 2 a.m. as drunkard feet pounded on stairs, as lights came on, as slaps flew onto helpless bodies, you stood unmoving and told Dad to leave. I never thanked you as you lay awake listening to the stifled sobs of your three trembling brothers. You, with your own silent burden of being the oldest brother, lay still, unmoving, wondering how you were going to save us. How, when my outer voice screamed as I was dragged out of the house, pleading not to go to that all-boys school, you calmed our parents as they argued over who was going to spank me as my fingers clawed at walls. How, as my inner voice became an inferno, its flames carrying insults, I'll kill you. You're not my father. I hate you all. You were present to put out those fires. You listened, cared, and said it was going to be all okay. How in England in 2013, as Susan for the first time, I sat in the old family living room with my eyes closed, whilst the smells of the house besieged me, in the dark oceans of memories, at times crushing, at other moments buoyant. I listened to you. You were working in the kitchen making tea. Your actions, as always, were careful and precise. You've had years to hone these traits, first taught to us years before by our alcoholic parents. Don't make noise. Who's that banging around? Someone's in for a spanking. The placing of cutlery, the quiet filling of the kettle, the opening of cupboards were all done with muted restraint. Tea, anyone? Just like a bird with its own song, your call has always been a calming sing-song rhythm. How I know your aim in life was not to put out fires and rescue lost souls as our family was shook to its foundation. Alcoholism, divorces, broken trusts, and hurt bodies. But you stood by us, each brother tended by you with loving care. Your successes, a junior Wimbledon tennis player, the treasurer for Norfolk County, a father, husband, brother, and uncle. Were these just distractions, diversions from your main calling of the rescuer? Is that why you've hiked thousands of miles on open trails through Europe? Are you on a pilgrimage or fleeing from life? How, when I wrote the letter explaining that I could no longer live in a man's body, you became my advocate, a sister in a family, an aunt instead of an uncle. We can handle this. It was you who paved the way for the others in the family to accept and embrace me. And how in 2013, as we strolled through the streets of Norwich, you put your arm around me in public, and still to this day, the only man ever to do so. My mother passed away this year at the age of 95. She was an incredible, incredible woman. And this is a piece I wrote after her death. It's called The Last Squeeze. The small, frail hand wraps around my thumb. Its weathered fingers still retaining a semblance of strength. I ask her if she's feeling okay, and two quick squeezes on my thumb are her reply. As I sit with my mother on this night, I realize this is how we were introduced on another June night 60 years ago when I was born. My first attempt at communication with her would have been my small hand wrapped around her finger and squeezing it, just as we're doing now. When vocal communication isn't possible, touch makes everything right. My wife Cindy and I have been maintaining a bedside vigil now for 5 nights as her mother collects her thoughts and summons up the courage to move on to the next stage of life. For the last few days, she's chatted and hummed, recited nonsense rhymes from her childhood, winced with pain, and let tears flow with frustration. As I seemed to sense 60 years ago that there was something bigger than my mother's womb and pushed my way into the world, my own mother seems to sense that something bigger awaits. I daub her lips once more with water using a small cotton swab and then take her hand again. She gives it a squeeze to say thank you. I've held this hand so many times, but never paid attention to it. It's a hand that guided me as I lifted my first spoonful of food to my mouth. It held me as I grew frightened on stormy nights, at my first sight of the ocean, of a steam engine arriving at the platform, my first day of school, my last day of school, at the airport as I left England, on my wedding day, as I showed her my son for the first time, and she took my hand and squeezed it. Then, as I became Susan, she took my hand as we entered the courthouse to change my name. I was 54, she was 89. She's never let go. And now, at 3 a.m, as she squeezes my thumb, I realize that though I'm comforting her, she's also comforting me. And I hear her voice telling me that all will be well. Thank you. So part of my introduction, you probably heard that I was a tall ship captain for 35 years. Used to be known as Captain Bob. And this is my wife, Cindy, with the white hair up front here. We've been married for 35 years, and we met on schooners down in the Caribbean many, many years ago. Anyway, the piece I wrote tonight is just part of a memoir that I'm working on right now. It's called One Day Susan, I Promise. And this piece is called First Night Out. And it's about sailing on a schooner through the Caribbean in 1981, probably before many of you were born, actually, looking at the crowd tonight. So here we go. The anchor breaks the surface, scoured and clean from the bright sands of the Caribbean Sea. The bow of the 130-foot schooner falls off onto a broad reach as sails are set, and she begins to roll in the building seas as we clear the lee of the island of Grand Cayman, our destination, Galveston, Texas. We catch the front edge of a low-pressure system that carries us quickly west to the straits before pointing the bow northwest to take us through its unpredictable waters. The first night out, we come on deck at 2200 hours, and we're met with deteriorating weather. The ship takes a roll to windward, the bow plunges, and ship water runs ankle-deep across the deck. Waterborne bioluminescence, glowing fluorescent green, streak across the deck in all directions, and then wash to leeward, where deck scuppers wash them back into the ocean. The wind has been building, as has the sea, and soon the 130-foot schooner is starting to struggle with the task of driving us northwest. With the last sliver of the moon disappearing below the horizon, we're left with a tempestuous night. I'm told to carry out a deck inspection as soon as we relieve the other watch. Moving from one handhold to the next, I work my way steadily forward to check that nothing is amiss with the schooner. As the ship shudders and rolls and a large wave crest hisses by, my feet become entangled in a loose line that has been swept off its belaying pin. Foresail, lower leech line, out of its running block, I shout as my flashlight pinpoints the block aloft where the line should have been led. This is the second largest sail on the schooner, and if we need to reef the sail, the line needs to be re-led immediately. The first mate is next to me in an instant and snatches the line out of my hand. God damn it. What asshole didn't cleat this off properly? Was it you? At 3 a.m, my only reply is, the last watch, sir. They're always sloppy. The mate turns and shouts aft, volunteer to go aloft. Before he can say another word, I have the line in my hand, and I'm at the base of the 80-foot Douglas fir mast, ready to scurry aloft. This is normally a simple climb, using the mast hoops that hold the sail to the mast for footing. But tonight, the hoops are covered with grease, used to prevent chafing on the wooden mast. The schooner takes another roll to windward, and the mate screams to hang on. As the ship reaches the end of its sway and the rig starts to return to leeward, I see my chance and jump onto the first hoop, climb frantically aloft, pass the line through its block, put the bitter end of the line in my teeth, and quickly return to deck. I find a firm footing on deck as the ship returns to its wild windward roll. I timed it perfectly. I cleat the line off quickly on the belaying pin, but realize it's been led improperly and will not run free, a wasted trip. We pull the line back to deck and get it ready to be sent back aloft. The darkness and the constant waves breaking on deck make this difficult. By now, everyone on watch except for the mate think we should wait till daylight. Why? Do I get to sail with you lot? The mate screams as he tells me to go back up and do it right. 5 minutes later, we have the line coiled and free to run as I step onto the first hoop again. It's now slippery with grease, but using other handholds, I start to climb, bracing my body as the ship now starts to roll and pitch with greater frequency. This time, it takes me 5 minutes to reach the block, reeve the line, and get ready to climb back down. A gust and a shift of wind drives the schooner off course, and a sudden roll to windward leaves my legs dangling in midair. I regain my footing and look down to see the deck completely awash as waves swamp the ship. The schooner finishes its roll to windward, slips off a wave, and heads off downwind. At the same time, the heavy sail canvas lashes across the boat and thwacks me. I can't for the life of me fathom what can wallop me that hard, nor pry my fingers loose so easily. My body is hurled into the black darkness where I find myself suspended, and just for a split second, I'm aware of being only 23 years old before I fall. Someone once told me, it's not the falling that hurts, it's when you stop. How right they are. Providence is the leeward roll of a ship. Providence is a piece of rope hitting my leg, spinning me in midair and changing the direction of the fall. Providence is a 17-foot wooden longboat strapped amidships on deck that breaks my fall as I bounce off it from 45 feet above and slump onto the deck. Providence is not being sucked into the black crested wave that wants to sweep me overboard and down to Davy Jones's locker, the resting place of all sailors drowned at sea. I lie crumpled and unmoving, a heap of foul weather gear and sea boots. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Our next reader is Genesis Ellis. Genesis Ellis is a two-spirited, bi-gender, and queer public speaker, organizer, and writer in what they call the aloof loner tradition. They go by many names and many pronouns. He's an agoraphobic who lives with his partner and a tiny dog named Dee Dee. In her spare time, she enjoys making mixed-medium art collage about what it means to be a queer femme in the Pacific Northwest. Please help me welcome Genesis Ellis.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm going to be reading a piece from my memoir that is as yet untitled, but the piece I'm reading from it, hold on, is called The Sociopath That Tried to Get Down My Pants. Do you have any feelings you'd like to share with the group? Fuck you all, I hate it here, I said, my legs curled up, occupying the smallest space possible on the corner of an otherwise unoccupied couch. The house meeting was in full swing. The live-in counselor had just regaled us all with the excruciatingly boring exploits of his Canadian curling team. No doubt something he had prepared to say earlier that had been on his list of safe topics to share. Across from me sat my ex-boyfriend, Kevin. He snickered at the comment. The rest of the house stayed silent, their eyes glazed over and fixated on different spots on the wall, each dreading their own turn to share feelings. To my other side in a big, smooshy armchair was Angel the sociopath. Our eyes locked briefly, and he smiled. Would you like to talk about why you hate it here? The live-in asked in his best non-confrontational tone. Why do I have to come to these meetings, I asked. Everyone has to come to the weekly meetings, house rules. He then went over all the house rules again. No guests overnight, no guests during the day without putting it on the guest sign-up sheet, no sleeping in other housemates' rooms or hanging out after 10, no locked doors, no food in your room, weekly meetings with the house, bi-weekly one-on-one meetings with the live-in, no drugs, no alcohol, do your chores. I spent the rest of the meeting thinking about how I'd already broken all of these rules and how I would break them again, most likely with my ex-boyfriend, Kevin. We'd reconnected after discovering that we'd both been roped into living in transitional mental health housing for at-risk youth. It was run by Christians, which had not been explicitly explained to us. Had we have known, we probably both would have stayed on the streets. The house was in a pseudo-ritzy Jewish neighborhood in Seattle. We were very aware that the neighborhood hated us and didn't want us there, as we were often carefully told by the live-in to be quiet and not interact with the neighbors. My housemates included a paranoid schizophrenic who couldn't stop picking the scabs all over his body, a girl with OCD who could easily be tricked into finishing your chores, Kevin, who I'm pretty sure was terminally emo, and Angel the sociopath. I was the only autistic, which I was quick to point out wasn't actually a mental health disorder. Yes, but you're still at risk, the live-in would chime with a fatherly nod. The first time the sociopath tried to get down my pants, we were at a bus stop. I had been waiting at the stop, and he casually walked by, slowed down, then backed up. Mind if I wait for the bus with you, he asked. Sure. Angel's skin was the color of red clay, his eyes unmistakably dark, and his pitch hair falling into his face. He talked into my ear as if we were sharing intimate secrets, even though nobody else was there. I like curvy girls, he said, his voice soft and matter-of-fact. I'm not sure I am a girl, I said. Are you sure about this? He grabbed my chin and stole a deep kiss. No, I said. Well, then I guess I'll just have to keep trying till you're sure. We made out for what seemed like hours. Our hands couldn't decide if they wanted to hold each other or not. The bus came and went several times. We stopped intermittently to chat about the medications we were on, the medications we wished we were on, and the medications we didn't want to be on anymore. I'm a sociopath, you know. I'm incapable of feeling, he said after a while. Then, I want to make love to you. How can you make love to me if you don't have feelings, I asked, with my bottom lip still partially connected to his, unable to break away. What, I gotta sweep you off your feet to fuck? He cocked his eyebrow playfully. Yes, that's exactly it. I don't think I can have sex without romance or feelings. Romance, huh? He said, the gears in his head seeming to spin. I can do that. He left suddenly, leaving me wondering and breathless. I didn't see Angel again for a whole week. He was enviously absent from the next house meeting, as was Kevin. How come they get to skip? I asked the live-in crankily. Kevin is seeing his psychiatrist, and Angel made prior arrangements with me, the live-in responded. Would you like to talk about your feelings this week? Fuck you all. I hate it here. Meeting as usual. Later, I got a call from Angel. Hello? Hello, sweetheart. It's your boyfriend. Ha ha. How did you get my number? I'm your lover. It's my job to know these things. Where were you at the meeting tonight? I asked, deciding to ignore his comment on being my lover. I was getting things ready. For what? For you. Want to come to my room? We're not supposed to hang out in each other's rooms after 10 o'clock. That's never stopped any of us before. Come over, honey. I want to show something to you. We hung up, and I spent a few minutes sitting on my bed in my room, breathing really hard. I was pretty sure I was going to get raped, but I was also pretty sure I was going to go anyways. I crept out into the hallway, first making sure the live-in was in his room. You could always tell he was about to go to bed when you heard cheesy guitar filtering out from under his door. Good. Not only would he not hear, but he would be putting himself to sleep soon. What a boring loser, I thought. I tiptoed downstairs, casting a glance towards Kevin's room. There was a sliver of light underneath. That meant he was home and would come if I screamed. But I had already decided I would not scream, so really it didn't matter. There was familiar music coming from the other side of Angel's door. Curiously, I knocked. The door opened. I stepped in, and the room was warm. Angel closed the door behind me. There were candles lit everywhere, and he was playing my favorite Vertical Horizon CD, a guilty pleasure band left over from my childhood. This led me to wonder how long he had been stalking me and how often he'd been into my room. I had to give it to him. He was a professional. There were rose petals all over the bed and on the floor, red. I expected him to take my clothes off, but instead he took off his shirt, unbuttoning it slowly. I have something to show you, he said, and I bit back the urge to say something snarky. When his shirt was off, he cast it carelessly to the side and turned around. I gasped. His back was covered in burn scars, swirly red and purple, alien-like. They covered his entire back, and streaks lashed across his shoulders and ran down his thighs. It was absolutely gorgeous. Can I touch it? I asked. Yeah, it doesn't hurt anymore. It was a long time ago. What happened? He told me the story of how his father nearly beat his mother to death, then went to pour a large basin of boiling water all over his 11-year-old body. He had tried to run away, but it splashed against his back. I ran my hands over the scars gently as he told me his story, mesmerized not so much by the horror of his tale, but by the intricate designs they made and their texture. Suddenly, I found myself holding him tightly against me, his scarred flesh seared against my chest, and he was calling me baby and turning around to embrace me. When he started pulling me towards the bed, I pulled away. I don't know if I can do this. I kind of just got out of a relationship with a sociopath, I said. Did he hurt you? Angel asked. Yeah, he kind of did. Like, kind of a lot. Did he rape you? Yes. Well, I'm not going to do anything you don't want to do. I might not have feelings, but I'm not a monster. Where'd you get this CD? Did you steal it from my room? My eyes narrowed. No way. I love Vertical Horizon. Okay, I want to. Just let me grab something. I ran out of his room, and it was like entering another universe, a universe where he didn't just say the things he had said, and neither did I, a universe where he'd never been burned, I'd never been raped, we'd never lived in this fucked up house, and neither of us even ever existed. I knocked on Kevin's door. Can I come in? Yeah, hold on a sec. Kevin turned down Pretty Hate Machine. Kevin was busy doing what emo 18-year-olds do, painting shit with black sparkly nail polish. Were you really gonna fuck Angel? He asked once I had settled into a squatting position on his floor. Nah, I don't know. You know he's a sociopath, right? I know. I think I was just horny. Well, why don't we have sex? He asked, flipping his emo hair out of his face only for it to fall back in place. I thought you were gay, I said. I thought you had a strap on, he quipped back. I did. My ex destroyed it, along with all my other sex toys and lingerie. Oh. Well, I feel pretty gay this week, but maybe next week I'll be straight again. Okay. We painted some dolls' heads he had all over with the black nail polish, then a bowling ball, then an old yearbook, then we did lines of coke off the hardwood floor and talked about how much we hated living in that house and how the live-in was probably gay and probably gonna kill himself for it one day because that's what Christian closet cases do. And who'd wanna live in a house with a bunch of fucked up teenagers and not have any friends or life anyways? Angel and my ex and everything that had happened that put me in this house seemed far away and trivial. Angel never did mention the night of almost getting down my pants, but it wouldn't be the last time he tried. When I finally went back up to my room in the wee hours of the morning, I looked for the Vertical Horizon CD. It was gone.
Thanks, Genesis. That was great. Our final reader tonight is Calvin Gimpelovich. Is that closer to how it's pronounced? No? Okay. You say it for me, okay. Calvin is an author and organizer based in the Pacific Northwest. His fiction appears in Electric Literature, Plentitude, Glitter Wolf, Cream City, Them, and elsewhere. He's the recipient of awards from Artist Trust, Jack Straw Cultural Center, and For Culture, in addition to residencies through Codex, Writer's Block, and the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts. A founding member of the Lion's Mane Art Collective, Calvin has organized shows at venues throughout Seattle and performed at Henry Art Gallery, where he was also a featured speaker. Welcome, Calvin.
Hello. My name is Calvin Gimpelovich. Thank you very much to the library and to For Culture for letting us be here. Thank you very much to Susan and Genesis for coming out and reading so beautifully. And right now I'm also very thankful to my immune system for telling me I'll be sick tomorrow instead of right now. I have a book coming out this summer, and I'm very excited about that. And if you want to be excited about it too, I brought a legal pad and a pen, and I will send you one email when it comes out, only one. This is an excerpt, not from the book coming out this summer, but a novel. Blacked out. He took the bottle and smashed it into a tree. A want for glass like fireworks, for the thing to shatter, its pieces dissolved into rain. He hit, but the thing didn't break. Hit again, and the tree won. Reverberation made him drop the bottle, stumble, and probably, if he could feel it, hurt his wrist, elbow, hand. Stupid, dumb fucking bottle. It seemed like he was more sober, but then his vision went dark, eyes and mind out of sync. He hit his own head, smacking the side with his palm, like to get picture back on the TV. That worked. The forest came back, the moonlight, but a different place than before, though how could anyone tell, with everywhere trees, the same moss, bark, dirt, berry, devil's club, bramble, fern. In theory, there were moon and stars overhead, but he couldn't see them through the mist and endless drizzle. Still, a bright mist, a full moon kind of mist that he could see in, and if he wasn't so drunk, he wouldn't be tripping on things. Hard to know how far he'd gone in the forest, if, when he blacked, he'd gone deeper or closer to town. If the skies cleared, and if he were a Boy Scout, he'd know how to figure it out. Everyone fucking wanted to be a Boy Scout with the uniforms and patches and shit. Every summer, they set up a table at the high school, right by the army recruiters who came to school twice a week. Fucking camouflage wearing soldiers telling how exciting it was, how much money they'd make. Sam knew. He wasn't stupid. He knew there was a connection. Get the little ones into Cub Scouts, to get them into Boy Scouts, to get them to sign up for the war, get bombed in a million pieces, have fun using your GI Bill then. The fucking government wanted them to join up. His vision dipped. He felt sick. It'd be easier to think if he weren't nauseous, and he was lost, and the Boy Scouts, he hated them. He wouldn't have joined even if they let him. They said he had an attitude problem, and his hair, they didn't like the way he shaved, the way he cut it. Just like church, hypocrite bunch of conformists. He loved church when he was little, the musty pews with the sermons and the food and the adults. The only place he could remember people being nice to him, but he was different. And what did Christ say about being different? Him and his mother and brother expelled. Anyways, he wouldn't be caught dead in church now. He liked to draw pentagrams over his notebook. "Hail Satan!" yelled that sometimes in the street. Satan, God, none of it real, but the look on people's faces, like he had horns coming out of his head. Gullible, hypocrite assholes, judge not lest ye be judged. He hated this town, full of jerk-offs. He knew their secrets, too, in more than a couple ways. There were videos on his brother's computer, the spy cam, and Sam had lockpicks. He wasn't an idiot. Everyone thought he was stupid, but he taught himself to pick locks, ordered a pick set that folded up to look like a jackknife. Sometimes, if he really looked hard, he saw people's thoughts like speech bubbles coming out of their heads. He saw it or heard them along with the voices that floated in the air. There were always voices. He ignored them. Except for sometimes when he was drunk or tired or in a weird space. Those times he woke with a light too heavy, pressing on eyes and eyelids, when it buzzed and everything seemed underwater. When that happened, sometimes his jaw twitched, his little muscular spasm, and the voice came out of his mouth. It had to be a strong voice, like swimming in the river. There's always a current, but sometimes you're tired and you hit a strong one, and then you get carried away. That's what happened in church when he was small. He'd pray and listen to the music and the pastor and pray for health, his mother instructed. Your father's early release. And that was its own weird headspace, because he believed back then, he really believed in the Lord's power to save. That's when the voices appeared. He'd fall down, a kid, twitching and speaking in tongues. At first, the congregation loved it. "Hallelujah, glory be," the pastor sang. "This boy has been claimed as a vessel," asking if anyone felt the Lord in their hearts, granting them the power of interpretation to clarify the boy's words. That didn't happen. Finally, after enough times, the pastor brought a recorder to service and taped Sam speaking in tongues, sent an audio file to his superior, who sent it to the biggest linguistics department on the West Coast. Results? It wasn't gibberish. It wasn't Latin. He'd been speaking some native language, a local one, extinct about 70 years. And the words, the most profane, most curse-worthy content. The pastor apologized, but Sam, little Sam, had the devil in him. What did he remember? The exorcism, the failure, scouring himself in the bath with the rough side of a sponge to get the demon out, praying to be saved. Stupid him, confusing God with the devil. Didn't matter how many times the pastor laid healing hands, He couldn't go to service without his mouth opening, blasting alien tongues. Expelled to protect the congregation. Assholes. He bent and puked on a log. It felt better, sort of. He thought this part of the forest looked familiar. Sounds of big rigs on the highway. Must be getting towards town. He pulled a flask from his pocket, shook it, drank the remains. Blackness took over. When he came back, he was on the main strip, two blocks of shops that the locals referred to when they said town. Post office, gas station, hardware, drugstore, the diner, the bar, all closed. He watched his reflection through dark glass. Ugly, a round teen with dark hair, pimples, dark eyes, fish belly skin, and an overhung brow. A big reddish birthmark started under his jaw and splashed across the left cheek. He wore jeans, a shirt, and a vest, black and covered in patches. There were band names and anarchy A's sewn in. A big back patch showed a demon-eyed, knife-wielding boy from a film. The t-shirt endorsed a different band, and even drunk, he was conscious, self-conscious, of the way his hips pushed and distorted the fabric. It rained, but he didn't feel cold. The denim sat heavy, waterlogged, and the patches looked even dirtier wet than they normally did. He walked on, wanting to pass out right there, wanting to go to a show. They had punk shows sometimes at the VFW hall an hour away. Shows played once a month in a wood room with no stage, so people moshed and knocked into the singer, playing fast punk between the Eagles and the plaques and American flags. Pathetic. This was the biggest punk scene in this part of Oregon. Still, he wished he could go, but they took his license away. There were so many rules, even more than before, rights and privileges waived. He had mandatory meetings with his parole officer, mandatory drug tests, counseling, scholastic attendance. If a police officer wanted to search him, he had to comply. He couldn't drink, had to work 20 hours a week, or do as much community service. That was American freedom. They got him a job frying chicken, 6-7 hours a day standing up, dropping baskets and sputtering oil, washing up, putting food in greasy white bags, and handing the bags out to drivers. His manager watching, telling him that he'd fucked up, but this was his chance. If he worked hard, Sam could have his own franchise. Telling him not to wear ripped pants, to put on the hairnet. The manager not working himself, but drinking a soda, watching Sam, telling him to speed up, do this, do that, don't take a break. It's not your break time. Someone from school came, and now they all knew, all showed up, carloads of them from the high school. They laughed, took pictures of him holding the bags, wearing the hairnet, told him to smile, made huge orders and changed their minds at the end. The manager drinking his Coke, telling him to go ahead and redo the order, saying, "This! Now this is an honest dollar." He had to get out. Grant, his brother, had left, escaped to L.A. Or, not L.A., pit stopped in San Francisco. Grant sent him a letter in juvie with the address. Sam wrote back, but Grant didn't answer. Sam planned to run away, meet his brother, and go with him to L.A. A new life, where the sun kept everyone dry. Tired, drunk, wet, he needed a break. Sat on the pavement and closed his eyes for only a second. Opened them, pulled himself up, and leaned on the bar. In the window, he saw himself, but the reflection was wrong. He looked like a girl. Same birthmark, same clothes, but female. Two breasts jutted out front, heavy and round in his shirt. He touched his chest, his real chest, and found the vision confirmed. Breasts squished under his hand. He dropped it, shocked, like he'd been zapped by a fence. Looked at the image again, saw the breasts, saw the girl, thought he was going insane. His hands went back to the tits, and then a horrible thought. He touched his dick, or where his dick ought to be, and found it absent. That was too much. The ground bucked, and he grabbed at the window for balance. His vision rocked and righted itself. When it calmed, he had a normal reflection. Hands on chest, on groin, everything in order. He must have blacked, had a weird dream. It happens. Sometimes, out of the corner of his eye, he saw people that weren't there. Compared to that, this wasn't so nuts. Just a weird little dream. He coughed and pissed on the side of the bar. Good. A pressure released. He wandered home, went to school the next day, went to work, went to school, went to work, and woke in the middle of the night once, thinking he'd had the same dream. Then it happened sober, midday, and that time it didn't go away. He locked himself in his room for 2 days, taking his clothes off, then putting them on, the biggest clothing he had, to make the curves and shapes go away. Breasts, hips, no dick, thighs, a shorter version of him, impossible. He was losing his mind. 2 days missing school and work and parole. His officer called, left a voicemail threatening to drag Sam back to jail for violating the terms of their legal agreement. Sam didn't dare answer the phone. When he spoke, the words were high-pitched. No one could see him that way. He stole a bottle of rum and drank it all, hoping to convince himself that he was just drunk, that when he sobered, it would go away. That didn't work. Breasts dangled as he heaved on all fours, bent over the toilet. When he heard the sounds of his father at home, Sam hid under the covers. When it ended, his body shuddered all around, the way his mouth did with the voices. He was looking down at his hands, and he actually saw them widen, watched hair sprout over the wrists. The parole officer called again. He couldn't stay. He packed a bag, pulled a cardboard box from the trash, and markered a sign for San Francisco. From there, the highway, holding a sign, thumb popped at a right angle. Time to get out of this place. Crazy or not, he'd been there too long. He needed to find his brother. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Calvin. So now we have time for some questions from the audience. I'm going to give these folks some mics, and if you have questions, I would love to hear them. We just ask that you direct them toward the writer that you're interested in hearing from. People are feeling shy. I have one to start. Calvin, since you had reached out to the library to pull this event together, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the project that inspired the reading tonight and why you wanted to work with Susan and Genesis.
So the excerpt I just read was the very first chapter of a novel I've been working on for a few years. And last spring, I applied to 4Culture for a grant to help me finish the project. And one of the things I realized when I was working on the grant application was that there was a lot of interest in Seattle to hear from trans people. And this microphone works a lot better. So there was a lot of interest that I was hearing from 4Culture and that I was hearing when I looked around to hear more from trans and genderqueer people in their own words, because they get talked about a lot. And there is another group I belong to because I'm a first-generation citizen, that there was also a lot of curiosity I found about people who'd immigrated to this country or whose parents had immigrated to this country. So there's some navigation between the different cultures that happens. And I thought it would be pretty interesting to find readers who satisfied both those criteria. I think you have to look at the world in a slightly different way when you're moving between cultures, when you're moving between perceived genders. And Susan and Genesis fit the bill so nicely.
I started writing in, 2009. I had to write a letter to my son. I was living in Maryland. He was just finishing up at Evergreen State. And I had to write him a letter explaining what I was about to undertake, which was changing my gender. And then we had to write a letter to, we were living in a tiny little town on the eastern shore of Maryland, And Cindy, my wife, and I decided that the best way to explain this to people was with a letter. And we ended up probably reading that with over 1,000 people. But I realized that there was a lot of my story that people didn't know and didn't understand. It was a big, like a lot of us when we come out, it's a big shock to a lot of people when we say, hey, you know, this is, I'm not quite who you think I am. It kind of took off from there. And it's a work in progress. I don't know, you know, when it's going to get finished, but I'm plugging away at it. And I find a lot of times, as many writers know, I look back at what I wrote 5 years ago, and I'm like, I've got to rewrite that. So.
Sure. Okay. So the question was the practice of writing in our everyday lives and what that means to us, what that looks like, what it does for you. Okay. Well, I'll answer first. I try and write every day, and most days I do write for 1 to 5 hours a day, and it's for me at least, it's very emotionally taxing. So, you know, I can't handle too many social interactions in a day, but at the same time, it's very rewarding, and it's just something that I feel like I have to do. It's kind of like food. Like, if I didn't do it, I would starve. So that's for me.
Yeah, I wish I was a little more disciplined, but I try and write. I have a writer's group that I meet with every Thursday. And usually it's bringing, you know, 600 to 700 words of a completed piece. So that's kind of my goal every week is, okay, let me just continue. The thing I've got to look out for, though, in writing these shorter pieces is incorporating it into chapters. A lot of times, you know, I end up rushing a part of a story when I could be extending it out. As I go back now, I'm trying to connect a lot of these short stories into a long narrative. I'll start, I guess. Yeah, I've written some fiction. I just find I'm still trying to work out what's going on with my life. And I find putting it down on paper downloads it from my head and makes it a lot clearer as to what my life has been. So, you know, I didn't, real quickly, I started therapy for gender dysphoria when I was 26. And I finally came out as Susan at 55. So there's a lot of stuff that I still need to work out, and I find writing about it is the best way for me to process it.
I write a lot of fiction as well as nonfiction, and I would say the difference is fiction is like candy. That's what I write to relax and for fun. And nonfiction is more like therapy. Therapy that is really hard to do and really, really sucks. But it's better for you in the long run.
I'm using this microphone. I wrote the first nonfiction piece I'd ever written at the end of this summer, and I found the process much more stressful because I was writing it as the payment for the residency I did in Las Vegas this summer. I had to write a piece about Las Vegas, and I felt so much desire for everything I said to be an incontestable fact, to be, like, fair. And so, like, encompass a whole city, and to encompass a city, you have to encompass a country and the world and the time period and all of history, it seemed like, which gives you a clue as to how my research went, where I spent several weeks on Wikipedia after the residency stressing out about Manifest Destiny and how that related to Las Vegas, which is not an exaggeration. whereas like finally got it together and wrote a piece, and it's on Electric Literature. But that desire to like have a source for every single sentence, or maybe multiple sources for every single sentence, and to be fair, was very distracting. So at least with fiction, it's my world, and who can tell me it's wrong?
Just prose for me.
So I don't actually technically know what prose is. It's not poetry? Oh, okay. I write poetry as well, but mostly prose, yeah. Ooh, well, poetry is very self-serving, so I don't usually share it.
Prose. Only prose. Only ever prose. Poetry, I think, is more emotionally intelligent than I want to be.
So the main theme of my memoir is trauma, because I've experienced a lot of trauma in my life, and I think that's interesting, and that's what's important for me to write. And the interesting thing about trauma is that it does something to your brain where you can't remember things linearly. So my memoir isn't linear. It's a lot of pieces that stand alone. I'm trying to write it so they stand alone. They also do connect, but not in like a beginning to end sort of way. I suppose if you were like a huge fan of mine and you were a nerd, you could try and piece it together yourself. But I won't.
Yeah, thank you, all of you, for coming out tonight, and for the library especially. Thank you ever so much. Really touched.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.